Nature is always one step ahead when it comes to beauty. She's quite the artist. I place the files on the floor, clearing space on the desk in front of me. Something falls out. A photo. Potential number 3. Koa. I slip it back inside the cardboard folder it came from. I'm not ready for that yet. I wave my hand through the tree's leaves, the glowing greens flowing around my fingers like we're connected.
Morning.
Hartman croaks behind me. Hey, I reply, pulling my hand from the screen.
Coffee? He asks.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I need right now. One of the perks of living in the tower. They grow coffee here.
Can you believe this stuff just used to grow out there?
Hartman says as he loads a coffee pill into the machine. Totally extinct in the wild now. Shame. No coffee. What the hell do they drink out there? He takes a deep breath and revels in the strong aroma.
Ah, God bless science.
He makes a cross with his hands, mimicking the religious symbol for the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I chuckle at the lack of a female presence in the ancient gesture to which so many still cling.
What's funny?
Hartman asks.
Coffee, I reply.
He returns a confused frown.
A powerful plant that Mother Nature took from us, yet we still have it, locked away in this place for our own satisfaction. We study it, experiment on it, consume it, and try to reproduce as much of it as we can for future generations.
He still looks confused. Remind you of anyone?
The floods came when we built an ark, dude. Welcome aboard, Hartman says, rolling his eyes at me and handing me a cup.
My nostrils flare in anticipation of the caffeine I'm about to consume as its scent wafts my way. Okay, maybe those mutated trees aren't so bad after all.
I love coffee, I sigh.
Yeah, it's worth not getting kicked out of this place just for this stuff, Hartman says, knocking his shatterproof mug against mine.
Cheers.
Cheers. We sip and stay silent, savoring the coffee, our unspoken words making us both smile. We've been through a lot together. The room is suddenly engulfed in a deep red light and a screaming siren pierces my eardrums. Fire.
Shit! Is this a drill? Hartman shouts over the alarm. I didn't see one on the schedule.
I lie. I've not even glanced at it.
That's not the fire siren. Listen,
he says, putting his finger on his lips. We hear the muffled announcement from outside our door.
This is an emergency evacuation. Please follow your hosts to your designated evacuation point.
It is Vivian's pre-recorded voice.
Shit,
he says, panicked.
Let's go.
I follow his lead, sliding my heavy boots onto bare feet. Our doors slide open as we approach it, and we are suddenly consumed by chaos. Hundreds of men are moving down the corridor towards us, guided by holographic hosts. The appearance of their virtual femininity has no effect among the EPO employees. We're all used to seeing these representations of a young female form. We interact with them as we would with any other employee. At least, that's the idea. But with an emergency evac on the cards, there's more to be concerned about than EPO protocol for holograms.
What the hell?
Hartman says, staring at the commotion as the first EPO employee gives in to the crush and pushes forward. This is not good, I say as the first men step through the holograms, breaking the illusion. Others follow through the light and the hollow hosts step aside in defeat, still speaking their pre-programmed emergency script.
Slowly follow the strip lighting to your assigned evacuation point. Do not push. Do not run, they mutter while the men who share our floor scramble towards the exit chutes.
I guess we better get going, I shout.
Hartman and I step out into the flowing river of bodies, trying not to be swept away in the current. Our assigned evacuation point is not the same as theirs, unfortunately. The tower's summit is over 4,000 meters tall at the pole of the dome. That's 2.5 miles high. We're currently pushing through the human crush on our dorm level as we head to our designated escape route.
Slowly, commands one of the hollow officers, as a couple of people are trampled along the corridor behind us, the red emergency lighting adding to the panic.
God, I hope this is just a drill, Hartman bellows. I do not feel like taking the leap of faith today.
When the tower was built, they had to invent safety features that could get its occupants out and down to ground level, if necessary. They tried everything. Parachutes, inflatables, small unpiloted aircraft.
Eventually, two external methods of escape were selected. The first and safest are the chutes, long tubes that drop down the side of the building at an almost vertical angle. The idea is to climb in, close your eyes, and enjoy the ride while you plummet to what you pray is safety as you hit the air cushions at ground level. However, only one person can use a chute at a time. It takes approximately 50 seconds to ride the chute from the upper levels to the bottom. A full evacuation of the building using this method alone would take days. The second means of escape is the one we're currently running towards. It's what we call the leap of faith, and you have to be trained to use it, so only a small percentage of the tower's staff are allowed to go near it. Unfortunately, pilots are in that small percentage. "Is this a drill?" Locke calls from behind us as we push through a side door leading us away from the crowds heading towards the chutes. "Dunno," Hartman replies as we pick up speed. "If it isn't a drill, you're going to freeze your nuts off in those shorts," Locke says, referring to my casuals. He has a point. Hartman leads us into the evacuation corridor. It's already lined with 100 or so tower personnel, all male. The women who work and live in here have separate internal evacuation methods, far safer than ours, for obvious reasons.
"Fall in at the back,"
Ketch commands from the far end of the long circular hall. We do as he says. My heart is pounding. A slight breeze weaves through the fine hairs on my legs. Cold air. Real air. Somewhere up ahead, a hatch has been opened. "You feel that?" I ask. "Cold air?" "Yeah," Locke replies. "Is this for real? Are we actually doing this?" Hartman asks the guys ahead of us, who must be one of the engineer crews, judging by their stained coveralls and filthy hands. "Not sure, but we've never known them to open a hatch during a drill before," the nearest replies, concern mixed with excitement on his face. "People love a bit of drama in here." "Please walk calmly and quietly," a female voice cuts through our nerves. "Holy shit," the filthy engineer replies as a young woman comes into view ahead. The unexpected sight of her perfection takes his breath away. She eyes the line, making sure everyone is conforming to protocol. Her black hair is tied back in a tight ponytail. She's focused, strong. "She's just another hologram, you idiot," Locke tells the open-mouthed man. "She's not real. They must have put her here to calm us down." "Actually, she's a projectant," I correct him. "A what?" Locke says, taking a closer look. "She's not programmed. She's a real thinking mind," I say. The difference between holograms and projectants is subtle, especially at a casual encounter like this, but I remember the program well enough to recognize one. It's the imperfections that give them away. The nervous tremor of a lip, the slight twitch in an eye. They're as close to being real as you can get, but, like humans, no one is perfect. This one's little finger won't keep still, causing her to grip her hands behind her back to retain her aura of authority. A hologram would never do that. This alone gives her away, if only to me. "Out onto the walkway, single file," she says, as she marches along the line of men with an air of authority that Vivian Silver would have been proud of. "Gentlemen, you look like you've seen a ghost. Shall we focus on the task at hand? I'd hate for any of you to fall to your deaths today," she smirks. Her words sober the men up as she walks back down the line and out through the open hatch. "Follow me onto the walkway, please, and remember to pick up an oxynate as you exit," she says calmly, holding up a small nasal device as her projection steps out of sight, causing gossipy whispers to erupt among the crowd. "Walkway? Shit," I hiss at Hartman. "What's going on? Has something happened in the dome?" My heart stops. If this isn't a drill, if this is a real evac, what's happened? "Where's Eve? Who's with her?"
"Don't stop, you idiot."
A gruff bald man shoves me from behind and I'm thrust further into the tunnel.
"We want to see the hologram. She's a project..."
"Okay, okay," I say, getting shoved along the tunnel. There are holograms at work throughout the tower, even out in Central. Programmed, organized particles of light that perform menial, non-physical tasks, glorified computer programs. The more advanced tasks were offered to the remnants of my father's abandoned projectant program. Overseeing the emergency evacuation procedure is obviously too unpredictable to leave to a pre-programmed hologram. It requires a thinking mind, even if it is an uploaded one. We creep along the wall towards the opening, towards the outside. My head is spinning. Why am I here? I should be with Eve right now. I would have been with her as Holly if I hadn't been such a dumbass. I should be calming her, comforting her, protecting her like I did before. Blinding light hits my eyes and stings my retinas. The air in my lungs is freezing and takes my breath away like I've jumped into an icy pool. We're outside. Don't forget one of these, Hartman hisses, shoving a small piece of plastic into my hands. I quickly insert the oxygenate into my nose, a small straw-like tube in each nostril, and feel the cool stream of oxygen begin to flow. Breathe slow. These things don't last long, Hartman explains. They hold just enough oxygen to get you out and down. What happens if my oxy thing runs out? Jackson yells from somewhere up ahead. Irreversible brain damage, the projectant replies coolly. You probably wouldn't notice much difference, Jackson, Hartman calls. Keep moving, gentlemen, the projectant instructs. My eyes adjust and my heart is wrenched to the bottom of my stomach as the sight before me registers with my brain. We're standing on a 2-foot-wide walkway with nothing below us but 2.5 miles of air. This isn't like being out on the drop. This is real. Shit-scary real. Many people are on their knees, trembling their way along. More than one person is vomiting at the thought of what we're about to do. My fingers are stiff as I move along the walkway behind Hartman. Slow down, I whisper. I'm a bit lightheaded. Keep up. We do this together, he says. Gentlemen, the projectant calls as she passes us in the opposite direction. My stomach turns as she steps dangerously close to the edge. Thank you for your cooperation. I now leave you in the capable hands of Ketch, who will guide you through your escape route. We keep moving until we find our spots. Each of us has a small yellow box with our name printed in black letters, bolted to the walkway. Listen up! Ketch's voice echoes over the wind, blasting through sound projectors suspended underneath multiple EPO drones that are hovering a few meters away from us. I've counted at least 12 in the glances I've taken. Looking out at them makes my heart miss a beat. Inside your allocated box you will find your gauntlet. Please remove it and put it on. His voice booms, and we all obey. I fumble over the lock. Twice. Let me, Hartman says, carefully nudging me out of the way. Watch it! I clutch at the railing and drop to my knees, breathless, hearing low laughs around me. The air is thinner up here, and there's hardly enough oxygen to satisfy my lungs, even with this thing in my nose. This, combined with the dizzying sight that falls away beneath me, sets my head spinning. Not everyone shares my dislike of heights. Here, get up, you're making a scene, Hartman says as he stands over me, offering me my gauntlet from the box. I take the equipment and he helps me stand, but I notice something behind him. It's the dome. I saw it from the outside when I was young, before we moved onto the base permanently, but not for many years and never from this angle. Pretty amazing, right? Jackson says, noticing what I'm staring at. I hadn't realized he was so close to us out here. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a pretty elaborate prison cell, but still, amazing, he adds. He always adds. We're standing at the base of the southern hemisphere of Eve's dome. It protrudes from the tower above us, creating its own horizon. I reach up to touch its outer skin, but suddenly the entire surface of the dome rotates. A gust of wind blows over us and everyone on the walkway clings to the railings. The dome's sensors saw the gust coming and adjusted for it before we felt it. Gauntlets on, gentlemen, Ketch commands. Then there is the sound of metallic clicks and rusty motors warming up. I place my hand inside the bullet-shaped metallic glove and its base automatically tightens around my wrist, more like a handcuff than a bracelet. The inner glove is rubberized and has a tight squeeze to stop my hand slipping out. Sir, these things must be over 10 years old. How do we know they'll still work? A faceless voice cries over the noise of drone propellers in the wind. That's why we're here today, Ketch replies. There is a pause as the entire group, myself included, takes a look over the edge of the platform we're standing on at the clouds below. Calm down. You'll be relieved to hear that this is a drill, Ketch says, obviously picking up on the vibes from every single one of us standing 5 miles above the Earth. I've never experienced a release of energy like the one that follows those words. A few people are sick again. We're testing these today so that should an occasion present itself where you are required to take the leap of faith, as I believe you call it, we can all rest assured that even if your faith fails you, your equipment will not. Now, if you'll all be so kind as to place your arms out over the edge and ensure you're standing at least a meter apart, good. When you're ready, you may follow the instructions printed on the side of your gauntlet and activate the blades. I stand immediately and hold out my arm. I want this over with as fast as possible and get the hell off this ledge. I've read how to activate these things 100 times or more. When you hate heights as much as I do, you make sure you know how to get down in an emergency. I shield my eyes with my free hand and twist the handlebar inside the gauntlet, as if I was revving the throttle of a motorbike. As it rotates, I feel a vibration, then some sort of release. The sensation of real moving parts feels dated compared to the technology we use daily in the tower. There is a loud swish, like a sword being unsheathed, as 3 fiberglass rotor blades shoot out from the side of my metallic glove, along with a cloud of rust-colored dust. That's not comforting. If your device releases 3 blades, it's cleared for the leap and will be reset back in your box. If your device releases fewer, well, you can thank your lucky butt that this is just a drill. Your gauntlet will be replaced with a newer model, Ketch explains. I look at the corroded rust bucket wrapped around my upper arm that just got cleared for use, and thank my lucky butt that today is just a drill.
Chapter 28. Eve. It's been hours and no one has come for me. I've tried my door several times, but it's remained locked. They cannot come in here. I cannot go out. I'm being segregated, kept in isolation, imprisoned. It's crushing. I know they want to break me so that I succumb to their will and curb my own desires. I'm foolish for having any hope for a future with Bram. While I'm experiencing a growing fear of what's to come, my enforced hunger is causing my emotions to fluctuate. I'm becoming increasingly irritated at my lack of control over my own destiny, and angry at their unwillingness to listen. I sit, wait, and think. Don't they know they should never leave me to think? I must have fallen asleep, because suddenly I wake up to sunshine pouring into my room and the click of my door unlocking. It should fill me with joy that I'm being freed from these 4 walls, but it doesn't. Instead, I feel my jaw clench and my nostrils flare. They've left me alone for over 24 hours, and it's my turn to play them at their own game, asserting my own authority. Morning, Mother Cardi sings as she wanders in. It's as if I haven't just been released from isolation. I catch sight of the tray in her tiny hands as the smell of cooked food wafts over to me. Brown sugar porridge. I made it myself, she proudly tells me, when I fail to turn over and sit up so she can put the tray on my lap. My mouth waters. I know how tasty her cooking is. I bet they've been talking about what to bring me first. The mothers know all my likes and dislikes. Part of me wants to consider this offering as a thoughtful gesture. A bigger part doesn't. Of course I feel for the mothers. I know they would have been following orders yesterday. I know it would have been awful for them to see me punished in that way, but happily or not, they went along with it and betrayed my love for them. I always want to believe that their role with me is far more personal than them fulfilling the requirements of their bosses. After all, they are the closest I have to a real mother. But mothers don't abandon their children. They fight for them. Perhaps the mothers are closer to them than they are to me. Not knowing who I can trust means I have to stand my ground against them all. And that includes darling Mother Cardi, with her inked skin, whose cheerful demeanor usually fills me with such joy. Today, I'm dead to it. Eve? She coos softly. I don't reply. I just stare at the blue skies outside. I've got your vitamins, too. Her voice is wobbling and she sniffs. I hear her suck air into her lungs and wonder if she's getting tearful. A lump forms in my throat. I try to listen harder to see if she's okay, although I don't contemplate turning over and doing as she asks. I'm going to leave it here. Her voice is firmer and stronger now, and I hear the tray being placed on my bedside table. I'll be back in a few minutes for your shower, she says, leaning across me and adjusting the sheet so that it covers my shoulders. Under the fabric, I feel her hand reach down and give my arm a tight squeeze. Quickly, she turns and walks away. It dawns on me that she genuinely cares, and that the brief contact was her only way of communicating with me because we are being watched. Of course we are. It's not me against them. It's us against them. Whether it's just me and Mother Cardi or me and all the mothers, I'm not sure. But it's comforting to know I'm not on my own in my feelings. The unity steals my nerve. I won't be eating that tray of food, and I won't be conversing as normal. Not today. Maybe not even tomorrow. I'm going to become mute. More than that, I want the mothers to know I'm not sweeping my treatment under the carpet. I need them to see me and know that I'm not a meek young girl with no claim on her own life. If I have to starve myself to death to hammer the point home, then that's what I'll do. Although I doubt things will go that far. They'll let me have Bram. They will. Fired up, I climb out of bed in the clothes I threw on yesterday and walk straight to my first lesson. Dirty clothes, unwashed body, and bare feet. If this is the only way I can rebel, so be it.
Chapter 29. Bram. Hartman has persuaded me to eat in the mess hall.
It'll be good for you to show your face, he says as we walk.
They'll only be making shit up about you if you don't. They make shit up about me anyway, so that's not a compelling reason to sit through dinner with Jackson. The real reason I'm going along with this new, more sociable approach is that, since they've restricted my access to our daily reports, it's the only way I can get information about Eve.
Well, look who's decided to grace us with his presence, Jackson announces as we walk into the mess hall. A decent-sized room with high ceilings and a long buffet counter that hasn't been filled yet. For some reason, they painted the walls green. Light green at the top and a dark green border. It's meant to be calming, but it gives off a more medical vibe, which I've always felt makes the food taste worse. That's why I eat in my dorm most days.
Jackson, gentlemen, I nod at everyone as we take our seats at the end of the bench. Today was interesting, I say, trying to take part in conversation from the get-go.
I'd totally have jumped if they wanted someone to test it, Jackson claims, stabbing a butter knife into the table in the gaps between his fingers. Something he's obviously not very good at, judging by the spatter of thin scars on his hands.
Would you have jumped before or after you threw up over the side? Locke jokes, and Jackson flushes, then shoots him a death stare.
On a serious note, did you hear that more than half the gauntlets failed?
Watts asks, pushing up the frames of his black glasses that constantly slip down his greasy nose.
More than half? Hartman asks in disbelief.
Yep. At least half of us on that ledge would have taken a giant leap of faith to our very abrupt deaths had yesterday been a real evac.
Watts uses his hand to demonstrate, slamming it down on the table. Splat.
Damn shame they didn't get you to jump after all, Jackson, I joke.
It gets a good laugh.
Why don't they just replace the lot? Jackson asks, ignoring my jibe.
It's a good question.
The chances of there being a catastrophic emergency that requires us to leap from this building with those ridiculous things is about 1 in 11 million. When you think about the resources it takes to replace every gauntlet and maintain them, you can see why it's not a priority at the moment, Watts explains.
He's always been good at keeping up with the politics involved in running this place. Plus, he loves a statistic.
Then again, they thought the Titanic was unsinkable.
The what? Jackson asks. Never mind. Watts replies, rolling his eyes.
Hey, what about that projectable thingy they had down there? I ain't seen one of them out and about before.
Jackson is still fiddling with the butter knife.
No one replies. Then I notice all eyes are on me.
There aren't that many, from what I remember my dad saying. When the program was abandoned, there were a lot of debates about what to do with them, I say.
Debates? Watts asks.
Yeah, well, they are conscious minds after all. Is it ethical to just switch them off? I ask, not expecting an answer.
Squad H think about it for a moment.
So what happened? Kramer says.
They stopped creating them and dispersed the existing projectants among the population.
Jesus!
There are more of them out there? Asked Kramer, fascinated. This is typical EPO bullshit. Should have just turned things off, soft bastards. But they think they're alive, right? Kramer says, totally getting it. As far as I know, I shrug. The green walls fade and the reality TV monitors that line them flicker to life. They blast an advert into the mess hall. Adverts like this are displayed throughout the tower. Whatever the EPO wants us to see, whatever they're trying to push on us, is repeated throughout the day at regular intervals in all public reality TV monitors, not just here but throughout the entire city. You are the last women of our species, a mature female voice says over a beautiful setting sun. Her voice never fails to make the men fall silent. Your bodies are the most valuable asset we have for the future of the human race. Locked away inside your body could be the answer to a new generation of young women, but technology hasn't developed the key. Yet. If only we could freeze time. The sun sets. Well, now we can. The screens plaster the same image multiple times across every wall of the mess hall and on the thousands of screens up and down the tower. A white, clean, high-tech room full of silver tubes. Your body can be frozen, perfectly preserved as it is, here, inside the tower, until technology finds the answer. When we do, you will be revived, revitalized, re-energized, and we will be equipped to start this new future, mothering the daughters we deserve. Can't be many left to freeze, Jackson interrupts. Shh! Kramer throws a spoon at him to shut up. We all watch the screens. Reflective cryo tanks, all with their lids sealed, housing the bodies of frozen women, their hearts beating inside at a rate of 1 BPM, beat per month. Time not so much frozen, but drastically slowed down. One tank at the end sits open, inviting. It beckons the viewer to step inside through the billowing dry ice. Should your time come before you've decided to freeze your remaining years, we can still preserve your valuable body and use it to shape our future, once technology catches up with our ambition. You don't have to be the last women on Earth. Visit your nearest EPO cryo clinic today. The screens become translucent again, returning the room to its green glory. You think Eve has any idea her mum's lying in a freezer a few floors below her? Jackson asks as he stands and heads to the now full buffet. Oh yeah, of course, like she knows that one third of her best friend Holly's personality is a complete tool, Kramer jokes. Crazy to think she's so oblivious to all this, Locke adds. I'm not sure she's as oblivious as she lets everyone believe. I can't help but get involved in this conversation. The cold storage levels below us take up the majority of the tower's square footage. They are full of preserved women, frozen in time, saving their bodies for the future, in the hope that one day they'll be thawed into a new world where science has solved this devastating puzzle. You ever been down there? Jackson asks. Cold storage? No, why? I ask. Just wondered. He sniggers, shoving some bread into his mouth. Locke elbows him in the ribs as we line up to get food. What have you been doing in cold storage? Hartman asks. I'm not sure any of us really wants to know the answer. I should report you for that, Kramer warns. Yeah, go ahead, and maybe I'll tell Dr. Wells what you and Holly do after hours in the studio, Jackson calmly replies. Kramer goes bright red, opens his mouth to say something, closes it again, and sits at the table defeated. I guess we've all got our guilty pleasures in here. We're all men when it comes down to it, same programming. Jackson grabs his balls with one hand while carrying his plate of meat in the other. Right, Bram? Everyone falls silent and looks at me, waiting for my response. Obviously they know what happened with me and Eve. So who is on duty today? I ask, not taking Jackson's bait. How is she? Silence. The table take quick glances at each other and avoid making eye contact with me. What? I ask. Look, man, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Watt says with an awkward smile. We've been given direct orders not to discuss with you anything that happens in the dome, Jackson interrupts, delivering the punchline. I can't help but notice the slightest twitch of a smile at the edge of his mouth. It's for Eve's safety. My blood boils. Hartman places his hand on my arm and I realize I'm clenching my fist. Jackson stares at me, begging me to do it. I breathe deeply. I'm in enough trouble as it is at the moment. Jackson knows it. I relax and smile. I take a bite of my bread.
You know, you gotta control that temper of yours, Bram, Jackson says through his mouthful of food. You're a real loose cannon. One minute all smiles, the next you want to throw that fist around. Unpredictable.
You know who else was like that? Eve's dad. And look what they did with him.
Eve's dad was a lunatic. He got what was coming. Hartman joins in the conversation.
You believe all that?
Watt steals in. Silence falls on the group as the squad shoot him a look. Words can be dangerous in a world where the walls have ears.
There's more to all that than we'll ever know. Jackson breaks the moment. Only those at the top are in on it.
What's that supposed to mean? I ask, noticing the little look Jackson gave me when he said it.
Nothing, he replies. No, go on. Those at the top... You mean my father? I ask, defensive of him for the first time ever.
It's a strange sensation.
Yeah, I guess. Never really thought about it like that, Jackson shrugs.
Maybe you know too, he laughs. I take a moment to absorb what he's suggesting.
Is that what you all think? I ask the team. That I'm part of some sort of grand conspiracy that ripped Eve away from her family?
My so-called friends look around at each other and unconvincingly shake their heads.
No, man, we know you're one of us, Locke says, but I detect a hint of uncertainty in them all, like they've thought it, even if they don't believe it.
I'm going to finish eating in the dorm, I say to Hartman, leaving him to conspire with the others.
Chapter 30. Bram. I walk for a while. My body moves through the seemingly infinite corridors of the tower while my thoughts navigate the complex corridors of my mind. So many dead ends. So many unanswered questions. Eve's mother and the conspiracies around her death, most of which were born from the interviews her father gave in the weeks that followed when he was cut off from Eve, before he tried to kidnap her. They murdered her. My mind recalls his voice from one of the many interviews he gave, distraught and desperate. A man who'd just witnessed the death of his wife, a man half responsible for creating the most famous person on the planet, father to the most important human ever to live. Enough to drive him insane? Maybe. I pass two EPO employees, both technicians judging by their navy blue uniforms.
Sir?
They salute. I nod. I hate the rank system here. The graying men are probably three times my age, and yet, because of my job, they're made to salute me, take orders from me even, if that's what I wish. I've always felt that life experience, age, miles on the clock, stands for some sort of rank, deserves some authority. Not in here, it seems. As my thoughts settle, I realize I've walked past the entrance to the wing that holds our dorm. I've reached the nearest lift to our living quarters. The metallic ball swishes elegantly upwards past our floor behind vacuum-sealed glass doors, its light reflecting on the polished black floor. Without thinking, I wave my hand over the sensor to call one to stop. It arrives within 5 seconds, which still amazes me. There are 1,000 floors in this place. The doors slide open silently, and I step inside the round pod. As I enter, a small beam of light fires into my eyes, scanning my retinas.
Good evening, Mr. Wells, the automated voice greets me. I can't stand being called that.
Mr. Wells is my father's name. I'm Bram. Just Bram, I instruct, and the system understands. I have to instruct it like this every day, as the EPO refuse to reprogram it to recognize me by my first name, like everyone else does. Damn regulations.
Very well, just Bram. Where do you require me to take you?
The voice asks, which I think is an attempt at a joke. I found it funny when I was 10. 8 years later, the joke's worn off. CS-24, I say. Cold storage. The beam of light fires again. The system is double-checking my security clearance. I wait. The lift has not moved since I stepped inside.
Of course, just Bram. On our way. Would you like to listen to some music on the journey? The voice asks.
No thanks, I say, declining the optional entertainment we're offered when riding alone in a lift. We descend. My eardrums throb with the rapid change in altitude.
Through the transparent walls of my carriage, I see floor after floor of the tower shoot by, each level occupied by enough personnel to fill a town. All male, of course. Men working in kitchens, men working in engineering, men working in the research laboratories. There is a female sanctuary in the tower, the upper level, the dome. The mothers are safe there, protected. It's an honor for them to live there. I'm headed to the only other place women are permitted within these walls. Cold storage. They're either confined to the dome, passively keeping up appearances for Eve, or frozen in the basement. If Mother Nature is observing us, it's no wonder she won't provide us with any more women. CS-24, Just Bram, the lift announces as we slow to a stop and the doors hiss open. Cold air floods the lift. It's refreshing. I breathe in its artifice, savoring the taste of whatever chemicals they pump around here to keep it sterile. I step into the dimly lit lobby. Hello, young man. A familiar face smiles at me through the dark. Good evening, Stephanie, I say, stepping towards the reception desk for cold storage. It's been a while, she says, flashing me those perfect teeth smudged with the tiniest speck of red lipstick. Busy times. Lots happening these days, I reply. There's always time for your mother, young man, she teases, speaking to me as if I'm still the same boy who walked through the doors to the EPO all those years ago. A lot has changed. Not just for me, but for her, too. Actually, don't log me in yet. I reach out to stop her fingers typing, and she instantly snatches her hands away before we touch. Sorry, No, it's okay, she smiles. It's just, no one touches us. I nod, and she places her hands back. I'll give you 5 minutes before I log you in, but only because you're a good boy who doesn't forget his mama, okay? Thanks, Stephanie. I smile, and she nods for me to carry on. It must be tough for her down here, hidden away where no one remembers her, no one questions her existence. I stare down the empty halls ahead of me, and wonder what a projectant would do down here all day. This place doesn't get many visitors. It suddenly occurs to me that she must be down here too. Stephanie, the real Stephanie. Her frozen body, suspended in eternal sleep while her mind lives 100 feet away, sitting behind a cold desk. Some afterlife. I pass a man walking in the opposite direction. He hides his teary eyes from me as I catch a glimpse at his security uniform beneath his long coat. He doesn't even glance in my direction. Not that it would matter if he saw me. I'm cleared to be down here. Pilots have free run of the tower for the most part. There are exceptions, of course. We can't just waltz into the dome, for obvious reasons, and Miss Silver's quarters are by invitation only. I turn right into the blue hallway and run my fingers along the insulated walls. A thin layer of ice collects under my nail, leaving tracks behind, like scooping up ice cream from a tub. My feet feel the chill more with each step. The temperature penetrates even my heavy boots. I zip my jumpsuit to the top. I'm not appropriately dressed for this spontaneous visit, but I'm here now. As I pass the first doors on my left, marked by semi-transparent strips of plastic hanging from the ceiling, I take a glance into the deserted hall. They used to laugh at cryonics pioneers, dismissing it as nothing more than science fiction. That was until it became a necessity. All these millions of women reaching the end of their lives without creating a new generation of females to replace them. Cremating them, burying them, such wasteful practices. Something had to be done. I push my head inside the first chamber, a graveyard of the future. I try to estimate how many women lie silently inside the seemingly infinite rows of vertical silver tubes in front of me. It's impossible to tell. This floor is reserved for deceased women, women who were frozen after being declared physically dead in the hope that their cells can be revived at some point in the future and, more importantly, used. There are other levels for the brave women who volunteer themselves for the process pre-death. The odds of their bodies being more useful in the future are dramatically increased. The downside is obvious, though. I continue along the hallway. As I turn the corner to my right, another figure is walking towards me, a young man, wiping his eyes. I've seen him down here before. Slim build, around my age, blonde hair poking out of the baseball cap he's wearing backwards.
We don't say anything as we pass each other. His eyes are puffy and his cheeks blotched from crying. This place might look like a science lab, but there is something spiritual about the atmosphere. Peaceful, even, like a cemetery. Except here, the visitors pray that this is not their friend or family member's final resting place. As I reach the entrance I'm heading for, I turn back. The young man is gone. I'm alone. I step through the plastic and shiver as the temperature drops even lower, making the hallway seem warm in comparison. It takes my breath away as my lungs fill with the frozen air. I can feel goosebumps appearing down my arms underneath my uniform. The lights are kept low to prevent them emitting heat. If science does discover the key to ending the drought of females, this place holds the future, and it has to be well maintained. My feet do the work without my head having to instruct them. I might not have admitted it to Jackson, but I've wandered this path so many times since I was a boy. More often then than now, back when I needed answers, when I required comforting. 3 blocks down, I take a right, and count 14 tanks in. I stop as I reach the 15th chrome cylinder. I take a breath and place my hand on the smooth metal. I look left and right to make sure I'm alone before crouching and running my fingers along the bottom of the tank. Suddenly my fingers find the small piece of tape exactly where I left it. I peel it back, allowing the thing it's concealing to fall into my hand. I stand up and hold my palm to the light so I can see the tarnished silver chain and the small cross attached to it. I sigh and rest my head on the tank. Hi, Mum. I swipe my hand over the sensor and call for the lift. I've been down here for 30 minutes and the cold is starting to make my bones ache. My mind is busy. A few moments with my mother is usually enough to calm me, but there's so much happening right now that even she couldn't help. The knowledge that Eve is unaware about all of this, yet it all revolves around her, weighs heavily on my shoulders. She deserves to know the truth. The truth. What is the truth? Who knows what really happened to her parents? Vivian and the EPO aren't murderers, but if something more did happen, then my team are right about one thing. My father would know about it. The lift swishes into place and the doors slide open. But from further down the hall, a loud clang echoes around the corner, passes the lift, then disappears behind me. I've never heard such commotion in these peaceful levels before. I ditch the lift and head in the direction the noise came from, my boots clomping on the surface hidden below the layer of dry ice.
For God's sake, man, you can't do anything right.
A deep, gruff voice barks in a whisper from inside the hall ahead of me as I approach the plastic screening. I peer through and ahead, see two men with headlamps operating some sort of machine. On it sits a large cryo tank with a small dent in its outer surface, distorting the reflection.
Who's there?
The other man calls, noticing my head popping through the sheets. I step inside. The men drop their tools and salute me the moment they see the badge on my uniform.
Sorry, sir. We didn't realize we weren't alone down here,
the gruff one says, obviously nervous at my presence. As one of only 6 pilots who have direct contact with Eve, I have a certain amount of fame within this place. My badge proudly displays the emblem of the dome and the large letter H informs any observers that I am one of the elite. It never fails to cause a reaction among the lower levels. It's okay, at ease, I say. What are you doing?
Got a fresh one,
Gruff chirps, nodding at the cryo tank on their machine.
Just installing her.
With all the high-tech science that surrounds me, I'm amazed that the installation of preserved humans is left to the likes of these two.
I see. And are you concerned about the damage? I ask, pointing to the fist-sized dent.
Nah, these things are practically bomb-proof. That little thing isn't doing her no harm,
his skinny colleague chortles.
She had worse bumps out there at any rate. She'll be happy to be in here.
How do you mean? I asked, intrigued by his comment.
The old birds, they haven't got nothing out there. These tubs are the only ticket inside this tower. It's why they all sign up so willingly, he explains. There aren't no jobs for them upstairs, he says, flicking his finger at the dome on my uniform. So unless they come in one of these, them gates outside remain closed.
I see, I nod. Well, continue with a little more care, if you don't mind. It's the future inside these tanks.
Yes, sir, Skinny says,
and they start hoisting the tank onto the red lifting machine once again. I walk away, occasionally glancing back as they slot the silver tube into position, connecting the hoses that regulate its internal temperature. I return to the lift and step inside the next that arrives. "Where to, Mr. Wells?" it asks me again. I roll my eyes at hearing my father's name, but it triggers an idea. I place a hand on my chest, feeling my mother's cross hanging beneath my jumpsuit. Something stopped me placing it back below her tank this time. I needed her with me. "Dr. Wells' office," I say. "Retina scan." "Would you require any music for..." "No." The doors close, and the lift ascends.
Chapter 31. Eve. I've been sitting behind open books, staring into the air in front of my face for hours. Not reading, not writing, sometimes not even listening. I've been present and absent at the same time. English, French, Spanish, and biology, it's all gone by in a hazy blur of nothing. At lunchtime, I sit in the middle of my allotment and do nothing but pretend I can see the flowers bloom and flourish before my eyes. My mind speeding up their lengthy process of development. Mother Kimberly comes to offer me food, a sandwich, I think, but I decline. I say decline, but really I just ignore her while my eyes remain fixed on the tightly closed bud of a rose. She soon sighs heavily and leaves me to it. Sitting in mathematics with Mother Juliet and I concur Holly, I haven't a clue what puzzle they're trying to solve. Their voice is nothing more than buzzing to my ears. Even if I wanted to, I'd be unable to make out the words they're exchanging or give them any meaning. They wash over me. They are unimportant and futile, given the turn my life has taken lately. I don't understand why they want me to learn all this nonsense anyway, or where they expect me to put Pythagoras' theorem to practical use. I've always known there was a plan for my life, a scheduled set of events to be followed to ensure the desired outcome. But ever since that plan came into action with potential number one, Connor, my life has started to unravel more than I ever could have feared or predicted. I feel as if everything I ever knew will never be the same again, or that everything I thought I knew, I never did. A large part of that stemmed from the death of Mother Nina, but recent events have forced things to spiral even further away from my past beliefs and ideals. I don't feel like the girl I was the day I turned 16, or when I met Connor. I don't even feel like the girl who helplessly watched her friend be murdered, or who kissed her virtual lover. I'm starting to discover who I really am, or what I could be. I've always thought of myself becoming good enough to fulfill their version of who I should be, but now I don't know if their opinions really matter. In my empowered mental state, I sit thinking about many things. At some point, I linger on the wonder of that kiss and how my first experience of a true connection was literally unplugged. It doesn't surprise me that I've returned to thinking of Holly and how much I miss Bram. That relationship was one of the many catalysts that have spurred my change in drive. I wonder what he's doing, and if he's thinking about me at all. My every fiber tells me he is. He must be. I can't be imagining the spark between us. It's beyond anything I could have fabricated. I haven't found myself thinking of food, not in the same way as I did before. I don't think of the fruit salad I'd like to eat or the milkshake I'd like to slurp. Now I think of how my body feels after almost two full foodless days. I'm getting used to the hollow sensation in my stomach. I'd even say I like it. It shows I'm taking control of my body and moving their claim to it from their grasp. That I can make myself so light-headed and weak shows I have power over it, and I like that feeling. "I'm talking to you, Eve. Look at me." Her harsh voice snaps my focus back into the room. I'm not sure when she arrived to tower over me, but her presence has caused Mother Juliet to cower in the corner of the room, and I concur Holly to disappear. I do hope they let her leave through the door, otherwise they're being really slack on this whole technology versus reality thing. Slowly, I trail my eyes up Vivian's crease-free white blouse and force myself to look her square in the eye. "I'm not scared," my inner voice yells at her. "I'm not scared of you." Her eyes widen expectantly, as though she's heard my head's whisperings and is daring me to voice them, to cave from my chosen stance of deadly silence. I squint at her in an uncharacteristically challenging manner, telling her I'm not going to budge, that I'm prepared to stay mute, despondent, and wither away, that their one chance of survival is on the verge of collapse. "Are you done?" she asks in a belittling tone, the sort I'm used to hearing from her. "You've had your fun. Now it's time to move on and stop sulking." My unblinking eyes just stay on her. "What is it you want?" A silence lingers. I know she's asking me this question so that I show weakness, not just for her own pride, but for the sake of everyone else. For them to turn me into a starved mute is one thing, but it says something quite different to anyone watching if I'm acting of my own accord. I imagine my reluctance to submit doesn't send out the image of hope they need me for. She needs me to talk. 2 days ago, I wanted to. I wanted to ask her about Bram and figure out a way we could go about making him my potential, my one. But her actions have shown me the answer to that. They do not care about me or my happiness. Their only wish is for me to comply with their orders and beliefs. "Do you really think we care if you don't talk?" she asks, as though she's reading my mind. "We don't. But you must give your body what it needs. That is not optional." Suddenly, I'm looking down on me, rather than being me. The sight of Vivian leaning over my frame in such a threatening manner causes a smile to bubble onto my face. The very fact she needs to use these intimidating tactics to suppress me shows I have more power than I thought. Her words, her physicality, it's all empty threats. After all, what can she really do to me now? I raise an eyebrow at her. "Oh, really?" she laughs, her face tightening in surprise before her arms reach up and beckon towards the classroom door. "Mothers?" Mothers Tabia, Kimberly, and Cardi walk in sheepishly, looking down at whatever is in their hands. No one looks happy. They seem apprehensive and miserable. "Either you eat, or I'll instruct the mothers to place this tube down your throat and force-feed you like a goose." "You wouldn't," I find myself saying, despite my desire to remain quiet. I can't believe she'd be so barbaric. My confidence dissipates as quickly as it formed. "Wouldn't I?" she asks, her face cold and stern. "Of course, I could just inject sufficient vitamins to keep you alive. I think you've forgotten how clever we are here," she adds, menacingly, not even flinching as Mother Cardi drops the tray and equipment on the floor with a bang and scrabbles on her knees to collect it. "You don't have to eat to stay alive, Eve," Vivian snarls. "In reality, you can keep starving yourself for as long as you like. But, and this is a firm but, it goes deeper than that. How many times are you going to defy me? How many times are you going to step out of line and cause a minor blip in our plans? Because that's all they are. Minor blips." She pauses, giving me time to reply. "I don't." "If you will not cooperate, lessons will have to be taught," she threatens. "There has to be another way," mutters Mother Tabia, who is clearly distressed. "She means no harm," Mother Kimberly pleads into her hands, unable to watch. "She's just young," adds Mother Cardi, once she's finally back on her feet. "Silence!" Vivian barks, irritated that those beneath her are questioning her methods. "We mean no disrespect, Miss Silver," squeaks Mother Tabia. All three stand a little straighter and bow their heads to her. Vivian looks at them, then back at me. "I will give you one last chance to eat," she says coolly. "Or these ladies will force a banquet of nutrients into your gullet and do so repeatedly until you cooperate. Understand?" I'm aware of a sob escaping one of the mothers. "And don't think they won't. If any of them refuses to follow my orders, I'll be forced to evict her from the building." Her low, venomous tone leaves us in no doubt of her serious intent. It's a warning to us all. "I'm not here to make friends, Eve. I'd be happy to have you tied to a bed and force-fed for the rest of time. At least then I wouldn't have to put up with this rebellious, selfish nonsense. I lower my eyes to my lap and note how tightly my hands are clenching each other, helping me keep my nerve. Very soon, we'll be at the point of retraction, a step closer to achieving our race's survival. Play your part, Eve. Do your duty. Her voice is slow and punchy, but barely above a growl. It's scarier than when she shouts at me. It's more calculated and manipulative, more than empty threats. My body curls and shrinks as her words keep coming. The public are on your side, but fail to deliver and that'll quickly change. You gave them hope once, but they will act in the most vulgar and crude ways if what they live and fight for is taken away. I'd hate them to learn it was your selfish actions that caused humanity's demise. They wouldn't think so much of their precious Eve if they heard she was uncooperative and not looking after herself. And if you're not doing as we ask, you're of no use to us here. We'd continue looking at other alternatives and send you out there, alone. Something outside must catch her attention as she looks over her shoulder and listens before turning back to me and continuing. But I'm sure it won't come to that. I've raised you to have more sense. She inhales a lungful of air as though wanting to say more, but instead she walks out of the classroom door. I breathe a sigh of relief and feel my head spin. The last thing I'm aware of is Mother Kimberly wailing before the world goes black. I fall onto the cold tiles of the floor beneath me.
Chapter 32. Bram. He's unavailable, my father's assistant Wu says while picking her pristine holographic teeth with her holographic thumbnail, barely looking at me from her perch behind the solid steel desk. Tell him it's me and that it's important, I say, not in any mood to be messed with. I've never understood why my father programmed such a difficult assistant. Wu looks at me through her small grey eyes with resentment, like I'm an ant at a picnic. Perhaps she's just programmed to dislike me. Look, Bram, he's busy and said he doesn't want to be disturbed, okay? She says, as if I'm still that 10-year-old kid wanting my father to fix my broken toy aeroplane. One of the downsides of growing up in the same place, surrounded by the same people, is that to some, I'm still just the boss's kid. Even to holograms, it seems. Now, I've got important work to be getting on with. Her eyes return to whatever trash she's programmed to simulate reading. Tell him I've been down with Mum, I say, and instantly Wu's face changes. She sighs. I knew that'd get her attention. Dad hates me visiting Mum. He knows it's where I go when my mind is troubled, when I have questions. Funny how the dead sometimes have more answers than the living. Tonight, though, I'm hoping that's not the case. Wu stares at me with her not impressed, could really do without this, resting face. I've had enough of waiting. I walk towards the door to my father's office. It's not protected by the same technology as the rest of the building. He creates the most advanced technological systems, but he prefers to be surrounded with things that remind him of his past, of the world he came from. The steel desk is the last metallic surface I see as I head down the oak-clad corridor towards his office. As I get closer, I can see light through the frosted glass coming from inside and his silhouette waving his arms in the air. Bram! Wu calls, her hologram glitching slightly as she tries to keep up with me. Dr. Wells! I open the door without knocking. My father whips around to face me from beside his leather-bound desk, but he can't see me through the visor on his head. A pilot's visor. He rips it off, and for a brief moment, I catch a glimpse of the display inside. I recognize it instantly. The dome. Bram? What are you doing here? He's obviously flustered. Sorry, Dad, I say, as Wu arrives at the doorway, appearing out of breath. Dr. Wells, he pushed past. I couldn't... It's okay, Wu, my father says, holding up his hands to calm her. You can leave us. Wu shoots me the filthiest look, then disappears back down the hall. Come in and close the door, my father tells me. I do as he says, and while my back is turned,
I hear the elastic snap of him removing his kinetic gloves. I've been testing some software updates to the system. I think you're going to like them, he says, pointing to the visor lying on his